Hi. So today on the Loopcast, I have Gary Messina on the show. He is a consultant with a focus on business in Africa. He's also the senior advisor to the president of the Corporate Council on Africa. So previous in our Loopcast series on Africa, we very much talked about very specific things in U.S. policy towards Africa. So AFRICOM, we've discussed China and Africa, but what I wanted to do today and topic of our next couple shows on Africa will be sort of getting a general grasp of U.S. policy towards the continent. It's something that it's very much sort of in the news because you do hear about the Africa, the summit that's being hosted today, this week in D.C., but you never really get a chance to do a sort of in-depth conversation. So today, hopefully Gary will help me puzzle through and think about this topic. I want to start off with, give us an overview of what you see as U.S. foreign policy towards the continent, particularly this administration's focus towards the continent, and sort of what has been its business policy and its sort of economic focus towards the continent.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon, and thanks for having me on the show. I think the Obama administration has done more, overtly at least, for Africa than anybody previously. The Bush administration did quite a bit with PEPFAR grants and other aid to Africa, but didn't really have a strategic policy involving Africa. Whereas Obama does have a strategic process in mind for Africa, both business from a business point of view, as well as probably a strategic point of view from possibly a military, not in the bellicose sense of that word, but just building up stable allies in the region. So I think right there, we can move on to specifics, but in general, I think he's done quite a bit to bring Africa to the eye of the normal American and the normal mid to small business. Large business seems to know what they want to do, but slightly below large business, SMEs, for instance, and below don't have that vision that I think Obama has brought to the table.
So, I mean, could you sort of break down the strategy for us? I mean, what is it? Is it a strategy that is focused on development and tackling the spread of disease? Is it something that's more security focused and sort of counterterrorism focused? Or, you know, sort of parse out and sort of describe the strategy for us.
Well, I think the biggest part of the strategy is his business and power initiatives in Africa. The problem with Africa, no matter how big the development countries are, for instance, Nigeria has been deemed by the Economist magazine, I think about 4 months ago, as the largest economy in Africa and one of the largest economies in the world. So, unfortunately, the power requirements, electric power, etc., in that region only meets about 25% of their needs. So as big as they are, as big as other countries are, if you don't have electrification and you don't have the power to run plants, you're not going to grow your economy. So the Obama administration has a specific plan with seven countries to grow their economy through power. And he's talked to all the big electrification plants in the United States, like General Electric, Symbion Power, many others, to put $7 billion on the table that he wants to have significant power growth in Africa over the next 5 to 7 years. And it's a very ambitious undertaking, but people are meeting it with a lot of vigor. Those Those countries include Nigeria, Mozambique, Ethiopia, Tanzania, Kenya, and a couple others I can't remember off the top of my head, but they're all sub-Saharan countries with growing economies, and I think they're really the top 7 to 10 economies in Africa.
So these projects, I mean, how would you, I mean, if they're building power plants, you'd describe them as sort of, is it accurate to describe them as sort of big infrastructure projects there?
Correct. I mean, for instance, I think at the summit yesterday, Obama announced $7 billion in new financing to promote exports and investments in Africa under the Doing Business in Africa campaign, which he calls the DBIA campaign. Or it's what he, I think, kind of really termed it yesterday. We've known it as African leadership and African summit process, but now it's kind of become the DBIA campaign. And several U.S. companies announced at the White House, say, new deals in clean energy, aviation, and banking that are at least in addition in excess of $14 billion. But he's gotten the World Bank together, the government of Sweden, by the way, pledged, I believe, $1 billion to support this endeavor. And all these commitments in total are over $33 billion, supporting growth across tens of thousands of markets in Africa in terms of job markets.
Interesting. So, I mean, is this, are these sort of the United States going after these projects and try to drive investment? Is this, I mean,
Correct.
for the US to sort of drive these investments and sort of bring money into the continent, I mean, is this a sort of a shift in policy, or is this something that has been going on since, you know, the Bush era and the Clinton era, or is this sort of a pivot towards Africa for a US administration?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, yes, there's been some work in this area for many, many years. However, as I said, I don't think anybody has done it with a laser-like focus that the Obama administration has. I mean, some of the things he wants to do that he's talked about is connecting American businesses with African partners. I mean, he's made a big effort to do that with USAID and OPEC and many, many other government, U.S. government agencies. These are kind of pillars of his policy. He wants to support existing and new American investments in Africa. He specifically talked about that. And he wants to expand access for American businesses to finance their exports to Africa. And in so doing, he wants to reduce barriers to trade investment. So I believe yesterday, the AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, some senators and congressmen and other people wanted to sunset it because it comes up for renewal in September of 15. And many people thought it was going to be sunsetted, but in meetings at the White House yesterday, he pretty much assured everybody, along with Ambassador Kerry, that that's not going to be sunsetted. That's going to be strengthened and implemented again for its next period of time. So that will reduce barriers to trade and investment and allow the U.S. government to have other tools to help American companies get their goods and their companies building new businesses or expanding their old businesses in Africa.
So, in terms of what's driving the Obama policy towards Africa, I mean, is it counterterrorism? Is it the rise of China on the continent? I mean, what is sort of, you know, outside of economic growth, what is sort of driving this administration's interest in the continent?
Well, all these things I'm going to talk about are from my point of view and not speaking on behalf of government and agency and organization, but as a person has been dealing in Africa, both publicly and privately, for 30 years, I think I can say the following candidly. I don't think overtly they're talking about security in that sense, but I think the undercurrent is there. The subtext is certainly to say, how do we strengthen our policies, and what do we implement over there to strengthen our backbone against terrorism coming from Africa or in Africa? Secondly, part of it is a business reaction to the Chinese. I'm sure on your podcast before, I know specifically you've talked about China, but I've dealt with China and Africa for a long time too, and the bloom, I should say, is kind of going off the rose for both of them at this point. China's been in Africa a long time, long before it was so overt to Americans. But they're starting to say, we're not getting paid from certain African governments. And African governments are saying the Chinese are taking over a lot of our resources and businesses and making demands on us that we're not happy with anymore. And this is over a 15-year period now. So the U.S. is finally seeing, well, maybe there's an opportunity where we can go in and do business where we were not blocked before, but somewhat inhibited because of our Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and long processes. If you had an Ex-Im bank loan that you needed, or even the Millennium Challenge, who's put out a lot of money and wants to, but these things take time, where the Chinese will go right in and say, boom, you know, we'll get you a power plant, we'll do this, we'll do that, with no regard for a lot of things. Things meaning certain regulations that we have to follow, or certain rules that we might have to adhere to, etc. So now that bloom is off the rose, American companies want to come in, and they see that the U.S. government now is strongly behind that process. They know that OPEC is behind that process. U.S. Trade and Development Agency is behind that process. Agriculture, state, commerce, all of them have major initiatives to be in Africa over the last few years right now. Strong policies within those agencies that you can look up online or go downtown and see. It goes all the way through transportation, energy, and Office of the United States Trade Rep, Ambassador Froman. He's very, very pro-growth, very pro-Ebola, and very pro-Africa. And I think that's opened up a great vista for Americans who are willing to now take the chance, where before they were too fearful that conflict would interrupt their business, or possible payments wouldn't be made, or whatever. So that fear is being depressed now and buoyed up by these White House initiatives in specific agencies that I talked to you about, as well as others.
So I want to maybe bring in China into our conversation. I mean, because of the length of involvement within the continent, and because they have a good deal of sort of migrants who have gone from China to Africa, I mean, does China have a sort of comparative advantage versus the United States when it comes to doing business and engaging in the continent, or is it simply because, you know, Beijing doesn't have a corrupt, you know, a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and because they don't necessarily have the body of law that we have, that they have a freer hand? I mean, could we get sort of, what is the sort of comparative advantage of the Chinese and how the Chinese conduct business over the United States? I mean, is it really just a simple matter of the law?
No, it's not. You're right. And that's a very insightful, incisive question that people don't dwell on. And it's a little more sophisticated, as you pointed out. You actually touched upon is sophistication. People are looking at things in a very black and white way, very binary way. China can do this and we can't. But it goes far beyond that point. And let's just take FCPA out. Let's say they both adhere to that. Let's say we adhere to that and they adhere to that. So that's not an issue for purposes of this discussion. And so what is the difference in their relationship? Well, the difference in their relationship is the Chinese understand cultures far better than Americans, in essence. We're America, 225 years old or whatever, apple pie, Chevrolet, and whatever, but other cultures are thousands of years old, and they understand that everybody's not like you, and they understand the drivers in different cultures and the customs and other rubrics that one has to follow before they go into a country, and they don't just expect to fly over, sit for 2 weeks at best, and sign a deal and go back. They go to the country, they live in the country, they stay in the country, they treat dignitaries from foreign countries with a lot of respect and a lot of patience and a lot of understanding. Whereas a lot of American companies and even Western companies want to go over and they don't want to really live in the middle of Sierra Leone or, for example, or Guinea or wherever. Now there's Ebola, I realize that. But even before that, those are the very rigorous places to be when you're in the bush and 200 miles inland of those countries. And the Chinese can handle that. They set up, they'll build their own facilities, they'll build mini power plants, generation plants for their campsites and their facilities and their small dormitories, and then they'll build one while they build a project. That project meaning roads or other infrastructure like ports, airports, land ports, seaports. So they have a better understanding and they have less risk, or they're more risk proactive than we are. We're risk averse and they're not. Now, partly they have the government backing them in more totality. I mean, in general, parasitical companies and have that ability. But even ones that are further removed from parasitical have the ability to go in and fund things and know there'll be some losses and some gains, but if you stay the long run, you'll make money. So they do that fearlessly, with wisdom and understanding, but fearlessly in the sense that I'm not afraid to go in there and lose a little money in the beginning or have some extreme circumstances, because I can help build that country and I can build things for the people working there that will make their lives and their quality of life better as they're doing the project. And America doesn't tend to extol that virtue of the Chinese. They say, oh, the Chinese. They come in, they throw money down, they pay people, and the next thing you know, there's a power plant. Well, it's not quite that easy, and it's not that gross either. It's more sophisticated, as you were speaking about, and it has to do with culture and understanding and the ability to go in country and stay there for long periods of time.
So I want to switch gears a little and maybe talk about sort of the experience of a business, of a U.S. business in Africa. I mean, I want to start off with, what are some of the risks and pitfalls of being a large corporation and trying to do business in Africa, and then being a medium or small size business trying to do work in Africa? I mean, guide us through some of the legal risks and the financial risks of engaging the continent, and maybe even some of the successes too.
Well, there's a lot of successes. I mean, there's some, GE's doing well over there and developing power plants, but they've been there a long time and they understand the culture. As I was saying with the Chinese, I mean, that's GE America and we understand and they've understood. Boeing's been there, Symbion Power's been there, But all these groups have offices and people that really live there for years and maybe lifetimes. They don't just, you know, drive or fly from Washington to Dar es Salaam or Washington to Addis or Accra or any of them and stay for a month or 2 months and leave and come back and forth. They really try to do some kind of capacity building within the community. They try to instill jobs with people. They, as they build their plants, they have to, they almost always get local content, and if the local content doesn't have the skills necessary, they build schools or training facilities to teach them, because these power plants obviously aren't built overnight. It might take 7 to 10 years before a huge power plant. There's some newer small power plants that can be built within months, but those are small wattage, obviously, but that's where trained people from the country can help. So the big companies have deep pockets. They have congressional support because of the deep pockets in their lobbying organizations and the whole composite of things that go over the large corporations. So when they go, they've done analyses, they've got congressional support, probably some White House support, not necessarily Obama or Bush or whomever it was before, but in the White House at significant levels, and work with their congressmen and senators and other businesses, and they try to partner with very established businesses in Africa. When you do that, your chance of success is much, much higher than it is if you just decide to do something and, you know, put a stake in the ground in some country and build it, whatever it is. That doesn't tend to work. Small and medium-sized companies have a little bit harder time, but if they follow that model on a smaller scale, they'll do all right. Manufacturing people can do better with AGOA. They should understand that AGOA is a two-way street, the African Growth and Opportunity Act. Again, President Obama said he was going to renew as it comes up for renewal on September 15th. So, you know, there's a lot of tools in the toolkit that people don't use or know about. Again, as I said earlier, I mean, things like the Millennium Challenge Corporation, USAID is really having a big push in Africa. One of their directors went there, and he's been there for the next few years. And that's quite a commitment for an American guy to go and do. And he's going to be transiting the seven major countries, that the Power Initiative is focused on. And I'll try remembering for him, but I think they're Ethiopia, Ghana, Kenya, Liberia, Nigeria, Tanzania, Uganda, Mozambique, I think. So those are the focus countries. And then when you have that kind of direct White House focus, naming those kind of countries and having all those presidents and their ministers here, among other, many other countries' ministers here today, this week, you have a good framework and foundation for other types of business going on. Because a power plant takes many, many things. It's just, you know, it's brick, it's mortar, it's buildings, it's things that GE does, but it's high tech, it's IT, it's the whole composite of businesses. And then, you know, spawning up around there, you have to feed the people who are doing it, and you have to house the people who are doing it. So hotels develop around there, and restaurants develop around there, and a host of other things develop around there. And that's what's been happening in Ghana over the last few years. Nigeria is huge, you know. I mean, it's, 160 million people, about 80 million alone in Lagos. I mean, I'm half kidding about the number, but not really. I mean, it's a significant amount of people, but they're developing hotels that if I put a blindfold on an American and took it off and put him in Nigeria, he'd think he was in Manhattan. But, you know, that's not what you hear from apocryphal stories or anecdotal information. Yes, there's terrorism, but there's terrorism everywhere. Boko Haram is something to be reckoned with now, but they're not that huge. They're making a mess of things, and when you're a terrorist, that's the point. A small group of people can disrupt a very large community. But taken in its totality, it's not that big a group. Yes, making havoc, but it isn't that big a group, and Nigeria is overcoming it pretty well. And part of the problem is the election for president is coming up this February, and there's where the heightened destabilization is going to have come about for political and other reasons. Good luck, Jonathan, is here in town. I think there's a dinner for him tonight in Washington, D.C., and I'm sure they'll speak about this, or people will ask him a question about that. But I don't think that he'll shirk questions, and I don't think that Nigeria by far will stop growing. I mean, there's probably more millionaires in Nigeria than there are in the United States. So that's my feeling at that point.
So, I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, you laid out how the U.S. approaches Africa, and it's very much top-down. It's very much led by... It almost seems like the way you've explained it to me, that it seems very led by government agencies and, you know, very, what I would say, top-down, where it almost seems like with China, you know, in doing our research for previous conversations, China's business relationship, you know, save for maybe the big investment project, seems very bottom up in the sense that it's migrants who move to the continent, who form businesses, and those businesses grow within the political context of Africa or the country or wherever they've decided to settle, as opposed to Beijing, where, I mean, In this U.S. U.S. approach, it seems very top-heavy. It seems very much led by government agencies or led by sort of policy as opposed to sort of naturally sort of evolving and growing. I mean, is that a fair assessment or is there...
No, that's pretty fair. That's pretty insightful. I mean, for big business, that's the way they're going to do it, and medium-sized business is going to rely on that model. There are some people that have done the bottom-up approach. Some small IT companies, some small manufacturing, parallel organizations and things like that who've done it on their own with the, we'll call it the Chinese model, the bottom-up routine. And that works well if you do that. I mean, people are fearful in general, though, in America to do that. The non-cognizante, the non-initiata, whatever you want to call it. I don't want to broad brush everybody, but people in business that want to expand their horizons, and Africa is a terrific place to do it, just have unfounded fears at some point. Some of the fears are real, but some are unfounded. I know a lot of people that are very smart, and I think you can talk to them, and they have no clue what Accra looks like in reality, or Abuja, or Nigeria, in Lagos. They've never been to Maputo in Mozambique or whatever, and don't have a clue of what it looks like or how it is and how stable those things can be. So there are some who've taken the bottom-up approach, and they're pioneers, maybe, or pilgrims, or whatever you want to call it, but they've done well. I know there's one small firm that I know of called Computer Frontiers, Barbara Keating, a woman, a white woman from the Midwest or whatever, is the CEO. And she's in 20 countries in Africa. And it's a small, I wouldn't even say medium-sized yet. I think she's getting it medium-sized, but she's in 20 countries across the continent. And she did it on her own. And now she's getting involved in organizations like Corporate Council on Africa and others who have connections to other big businesses and other non-government agencies and the U.S. government to try to help her go beyond that. But she did that on her own. There's many others that I know of like that that have done on their own. Now, there's not multitudes, but there is a lot. And but you're right in the sense that in terms of the multitudes, that's what China does. China does bottom-up. They go invest, then the ministers come over out of respect, the leadership and ministry in the country that they're in. And that just reinforces what their population has done or their business person has done. Again, not a top-down per se. Sometimes it is, but a lot of times it's not. I mean, you kind of hit the nail on the head at that point.
So I think we've come to sort of the end of the interview, and as when we end the interview, we always like our guests to give us something to think about, for the audience to think about as we sign off. So give us something to think about, to chew on about this business relationship between the United States and the continent of Africa before we leave for the day.
Well, two things or three things that I would think that should happen that you've actually talked about and hit upon. I think people should become more familiar with really the facts about Africa and understanding Africa and where conflict is, where it isn't, where stability is, and where it isn't, and then make business decisions based on that rather than apocryphal or anecdotal studies or not studies or conversations that they've heard. The second thing is I think the government should be more ensconced in our government and in Africa per se. I mean, like, for instance, I think his name is Andy Hershkowitz. He is the director for USAID, the young man that I told you that heading up the power program in Africa. He's here now for, it'll be 2 years or at some point. I think more American government entities should send people over there, but not ensconced in forts like, before in Libya, or it's unfortunate what's happened in Libya over the last couple of years. But when it was fairly open and stable, embassies were pretty ensconced and not participatory with the public. And I think our people who are representatives of the United States should be involved with the people of the country in which they are, not just at the top levels, the government or, my peer, your peer, but in the marketplace, in the local restaurants, buying the local clothes, etc. And I think third, what is AFRICOM going to do to strengthen stability in Africa? And is it ever really going to go in Africa other than being in Stuttgart? Now, some say they don't want it in Africa. You'll hear from some countries in Africa. And other countries say, we welcome it. So that debate, I'm not going to say which countries say I want it, which countries say I don't want it, but that debate goes on in Africa. But I think it falls on somewhat deaf ears up here. I don't think America feels comfortable about being in Africa. As an imperialist, perhaps, they don't want to look that way. Risk, not in the military sense, but go in there and not be militaristic, but have more of an aid approach. And I think the last thing I would say is there should be more trade and less aid for Africa. Africa wants trade. They want to do business. They don't want handouts, and they don't want to be seen as, a few millionaires and billionaires with a plethora of people that are impoverished. They want to build small businesses over there, and I think we should do everything we can to do that through trade. So that's what I would leave you with.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you. See you soon. Bye-bye.